gang. Welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's the, what do you call those Russian dolls where they're made out of wood and you take one out and you put another one in, and there's a whole bunch of them in there. You wouldn't expect it, but there they are. Well, anyway, that's what RBN is, for some reason that I can't explain. And go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, send the fundage to 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas, 78664. Phone it in to 1-800-724-2719, extension 3. If I can remember this, you can too. All right, so today we have with us Philbert. Philbert, welcome to the show.
Hi there, howdy. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. All right, so, Philbert, what have you been up to?
Well, I took it upon myself to learn a Slavic language, and one reason why is because it's very challenging. Only a few Latin letters, and who doesn't like a good challenge, huh? So I've been learning Russian. I've heard there's easier, like learning Bulgarian is a little bit easier, but I chose to learn Russian.
Bulgarian, yeah. Bulgarian also uses the Cyrillic letters. Polish used Roman letters. But, okay, so you started with how's the alphabet come?
Yeah, I'm learning the alphabet still. Yeah, I've learned a few greetings, like Privet is hi.
Right. What are you using to learn?
There's a few mobile apps I've downloaded. One is just called Learn Russian, and I've started with that, and it has the Cyrillic alphabet on it, and that's difficult. There's only A, K, and M, O, T are all the pronounced as they are in English, and those are the only ones out of all the 33 Cyrillic alphabet letters. Good to know.
There are others that look the same but are pronounced different, right? So,
correct. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of background noise there sometimes.
Okay. I do have my air conditioner on. I don't know if that's it.
Oh, well. Okay. Well, anyway, yeah, so you got the letter C, but that's not pronounced. Well, that's pronounced like an S, right?
Yes. Correct.
And then you got, if we see P, what's that pronounced like?
I couldn't say right off the bat. I only have a few of them memorized. I know B is pronounced as is a V in English.
And P is pronounced like an R. And okay. And then if you got an R but it's backwards, that's pronounced ya. Ya. Yeah, there's a lot of, and then there's some that just are different. So
right, like you have the little thing that looks like a snowflake or a star, and mm-hmm. it's pronounced like S Z is like zh. So yeah, it's fairly challenging, but you know, it's gotta keep your brain occupied somehow, and like I said, who doesn't like a good challenge?
Right. Okay, so you're learning some Russian. What else are you learning? Any Russian history?
I've been watching, some Russian history, because as I briefly mentioned earlier, that's generally something that is not taught, in depth in United States high schools or schools, period. So, you know, just something good to learn.
Hey, you mentioned you downloaded some apps. Have you heard of Duolingo? Duolingo? Duolingo?
Yeah, only through you. Yes, you've mentioned that, and I do plan on giving that a try.
I don't know if it's any good. I guess it's widely used. It's kind of like
you said. It's in the form of like a game. Is this the one you were mentioning about?
Yeah, it's kind of like a game. I started using it for, and they have versions of it in all sorts of languages. So I was doing some Chinese, I was doing some Russian, doing some Korean, starting in January, and I was going gangbusters, and I was, my levels were going up. I was every, you know, I was doing real, real well. Then all of a sudden, and I was using it on my phone, and then all of a sudden, I did something, and I started only getting the desktop version on my phone, and it made all the letters tiny, and it was no fun anymore. And so that's pretty much it. I guess I could delete my account at this point. It doesn't matter, because all my levels have gone down. So maybe I'll do that, delete an account and start over again. Whatever. Anyway, I don't know if it's that good. It's free. It was fun while it lasted. But okay, Russian history. So Dr. Duke, especially after all this stuff happened in Russia, he was talking an awful lot about the Kievan Rus. Are you getting back to the Kievan Rus? What are you finding out about Russian history?
Yeah, that was initially the capital of Russia. I mean, many, many millennia ago. Or not many, but, you know, what was it? 2000, you know. Or,
like 1,000 years ago or something?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Dr. Duke studied in Ukraine, didn't he?
He did. So there's a school, and I don't remember the name of the school. It's a big school. One of their recent Jewish prime ministers was a graduate of the school. It's like MUBS. It's like the something school of management and industry or something like that. But it's a big school. And yeah, that's where he got his PhD. So he was there for a while. I think he was in Russia and Ukraine together, a total of 4 years? It might have been longer. He was there for a while. And he reads the Cyrillic letters real well. I don't think he speaks very much, but he can read he reads signs and everything, no problem.
That's funny for me. It seems to be getting the alphabet is more difficult than speaking it and remembering phrases and in and of itself. So like reading it is, you know, it's seemingly more difficult for myself. But
well, if you're actually there and you're going
around,
you have to look at signs all the time. So I haven't spent that much time there. I went to the Soviet Union 3 times. I haven't been over there since the Soviet Union fell apart. I was there when the Soviet Union was falling apart, like in September 1991, I was there, and things were starting to fall apart. But
you didn't get to see the tanks in the streets?
No, they had tanks in the streets in August, so the month before I got there, really about two to 3 weeks before I got there, that they did. That's when the putsch was. I went in September, so early to mid. I guess I don't know why I was going in September, but that was my travel agenda that year, was September. Usually it would be August, but anyway, September. So I didn't see that, but I did. There was a building called the Russian White House.
And right, that's their like Congress or Parliament building, right?
I guess is it still? So it was the Russian Republic's legislature. Their Congress.
Okay.
For the Russian Republic, and I guess it stayed that way. Yeah, it did stay that way. I don't know if it's. I guess it still is. Is that where the Duma is? The Soviet Union. I mean, they had the Kremlin, right? And the Kremlin was the Tsar's complex. But then after the Russian Revolution, that's where the Soviet government had its headquarters, and it's a little walled area. And there's a iconic, I guess, Basil's Cathedral. With it's an Orthodox church, and it's but there's a large, more modern building there, which is where the Soviet governments were. And the Soviet Union had a legislative body that didn't meet very often. It was called the Supreme Soviet. And maybe it met a large space in the Kremlin where it would meet. But the was a high-rise building. It, I don't know how big, how tall it was. It was, could have been 30 stories. It was a high-rise, and but that's where the Russian Republic had its legislature, and the Russian Republic's legislature got very, very active the last few years. They had multi-party elections, and then emerged first as the leader of the legislature, and then once he got a new constitution passed for the Russian Republic, it established an elected president, and then he ran for president and won and became president. So going into 1991, he had the legitimacy of having been elected by the population. He had that going. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union had redone its constitution, given itself an elected president, but because Gorbachev was in such a hurry to do his reforms, and everybody knew Gorbachev would win anyway, they just, in order to save time, he had the constitution say the first presidential election would be in the parliament, in the Supreme Soviet, and then after that, every 4 years or every 5 years, I can't remember, but it would be the population that would be voting. So that could have been something that would have given him legitimacy, that it would have been politically useful for him, but he'd skipped it. So there was that. But yeah, the Russian White House, and I went inside the Russian White House. I just wandered inside, and the plaza in front of the Russian White House was where the tanks were. The tanks had when they put under house arrest on, I guess it was August 19th, it surrounded his dacha, his little vacation house, wherever it was, and surrounded him. They announced that he was sick and had resigned, and Vice President Yanayev, the new president. People didn't go for it, and Yeltsin didn't go for it, and they sent tanks over to the Russian White House where he was. And he walked out, walked on top of the tank and made a speech, and then the tanks went away without doing anything, and he became the big hero. And I'll stop this. In 1993, so like a little more than 2 years later, in October 1993, Yeltsin was impeached by the Russian Duma. Impeached him. He went to office, and instead he got and sent the tanks to the same square in front of the Russian White House, fired on it, just fired. And went in and had the army go in and arrest the leader of the speaker of the Duma, whose name was Ruslan Hasbulatov, and then also arrest the president under arrest. So, and then President Clinton said that made Yeltsin into somehow the Russian George Washington. There's a lot of history right there. That's the Russian one. But what are you finding in Russian history that you didn't know and found interesting?
About Ivan the Terrible, and I didn't know that Alexander the Second's father was a ruler either, and just little things, I guess. I'm trying to learn a little bit, you know. I don't know as much as you, but
I don't know.
One reason I wanted to learn a Slavic language is because it never occurred to me until a little bit ago that you can probably travel in a lot of Eastern Europe and be able to communicate, you know, somewhat with, say, in Bulgaria and Belarus. And Lithuania speaks a similar dialect. So there's a lot of different countries you can be able to go and communicate. I believe Russian is the dominant language in Tajikistan, too. I don't know if I'll be visiting there, but, you know, if I'll tell you one place I do want to see is Serbia. I would love to go hiking in the Carpathian Mountains sometime if I ever get a chance. And I believe Serbs have a Slavic dialect, too, so... You know, it's spoken all over, and hopefully I get to the point one day where I can effectively communicate with some Slavic people. That's the goal, at least.
Well, it's a big hunk of land. I mean, just Russia on its own is a big hunk of land. The closely related languages, the most closely ones are Belarusian and Ukrainian, which. Uh-huh. You know, I'm not fluent. To what extent fully intelligible, I'm not sure, but they're fairly close. Those are called the Eastern Slavic languages. Then you got the Western Slavic languages, which are...
Right. Known as the Baltic Slavic.
Well, there's Baltic. Yeah, the Baltic is Lithuanian and Latvian. And so they're grouped in there. Some people say, well, that's a different branch of the Indo-European family, but even if it's a different branch, it's
very close. Is Bulgarian not a Eastern Slavic language?
Southern Slavic language.
Okay, all right.
So the Eastern Slavic languages, the main ones are Polish, Czech, and Slovak, I believe. I mean, there's Czechoslovakia. Polish and Czech are closer to each other than they are to Slovak, but I guess Slovak's one. There's one called Ruthian or something like that, and I think that's in that family, which is spoken in a small part of Romania or somewhere like that. Those borders change. And then the Southern Slavic languages, that's Bulgarian and what used to be called Serbo-Croatian. Serbo-Croatian is basically the same language, but the Serbs... use the Cyrillic alphabet that you're studying, and the Croats, even though it's the same spoken language, they use the Roman alphabet because they were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and for a long time they were dominated by the Habsburgs, so they used the Roman alphabet. Whereas the Serbs had been under the Ottoman Turks, and so they didn't get that Roman alphabet. And then, like, there's Macedonian. I guess that's another language again, but I've been to that part of Europe, and what I recall was taking a train from Yugoslavia to Bulgaria, and the Serbs on the train could talk to the Bulgarians. The Serbs would speak Serbian, the Bulgarians would speak Bulgarian, and they could understand each other. So. Some of these languages are pretty close together, and the differences are more political than linguistic. So there's that.
You know, I've heard that Hungarian is a very difficult language to learn. I've heard that's one of the hardest languages to learn, other than the Icelandic dialect.
Well, yeah, and I don't know. Like, I've spent all of one day in Hungary. I went through on a train less than a day. It's not a very big country. I got off in Budapest and I ran around, and this was in the 80s. So it was when it was communist, and traveling that at that time, sometimes you needed to have foreign exchange receipts. You needed to sometimes have hotel reservations way in advance. And I ran around Budapest, looking for a place to stay, and I couldn't find one.
Do you truly want to stay out of the system? Are you prepared to buy into the biggest scam since the Iraqi dinar? If not, then put your money where it belongs, in your possession, not in the hands of an international MLM cartel. At Kettle Moraine Limited, we will provide you with the finest Swiss-minted detachable gram sheets of pure 24-karat gold for hundreds of dollars less than the so-called privately issued credit cards with elusive gold backing. Gold backing? The only gold that I want is in my back pocket, not backed by promises of an operation even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is suspect of, giving a rating of C-. To get the full story, visit SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com and go to the Valcombe Bullion Vault. Once you have read the whole story about the scam being perpetrated on an unsuspecting public and how you can avoid being a victim by purchasing these beautiful, barterable, tradable sheets of gold at tremendous savings and in the strictest of privacy, be prepared to take the steps to protect your wealth with the purchase of the real deal. Detachable 50-gram gold bars from Kettle Moraine Limited by calling 602-799-8214. Ask about our 1-ounce Valcombe detachable bars, which break into 1/10-ounce bars. And don't forget, for all of your precious metal needs, whether buying or having the need to sell, call Kettle Moraine Limited. Remember, no dinar, no celery, and no carrots. If you buy from someone else, tell them you want AU, not BS. Call Kettle Moraine LTD today at 602-799-8214. Kettle Moraine LTD, 602-799-8214.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive! Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my EaseOff?
Go to EaseOff.com, EazeOff.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
Sometimes you needed to have, or you needed to have foreign exchange receipts. You needed to sometimes have hotel reservations way in advance. And I ran around Budapest looking for a place to stay, and I couldn't find one. And so I just got back on the train and continued going north up into eventually Poland. But so I've only spent very little time in Hungary. I didn't learn any Hungarian, but Hungarian is very unusual in Europe because it's not a Indo-European language. It's a completely different language. And Finnish is the other one, the other main one that's not Indo-European. Estonian and Finnish are very close. And then there's the Basque language over in Spain. And these are the four examples of languages in Europe. I guess you could throw Lap. With the nomadic Lap people up in the Arctic speak, but those are the languages that are not of Indo-European origin. And the Indo-European languages, they seem to have their roots going back several thousand years in the area, I guess, north of the Caucasus Mountains, north. East of the Black Sea, maybe northwest of the Caspian Sea, but right around there in what is now like Ukraine and Russia and the Donbass, that area.
And that, Georgia.
And I guess, yeah, maybe Georgia too. So the Indo-Europeans, but the Georgian language, yeah, Georgian language is not an Indo-European language. But it is that area around there, around the Black Sea, that was this tribe or this group of people who they didn't necessarily invent the wheel, but they were the first to use it effectively for transportation. And that area that I guess they call it the steppe is grass, right? It's kind of like prairie, I guess, but it's grassland and maybe relatively dry. And for a human without agriculture, for a human just to exist in grassland, it's not the easiest. But if you've got the wheel, you can bring things with you. You've got carts, right? And so they had carts. They were using the wheel for transportation. They had carts, and with wheels to carry things with you, to carry water and some supplies. And then if you've got if you've domesticated the horse, which they had, and I don't know if they were using. I guess they were using the horse to pull the carts. But they were able to exploit this area that really wasn't very good for humans before, but they could exploit it. They had animals that could eat the grass, and then they could eat the animals, although I think they were more likely to drink the milk than slaughter animals, but they were doing both. But they were drinking a lot of milk and cheese and yogurt and stuff like that, and they were able to exploit this. Then around around the time pyramids were being built, pyramids were being built about 2700 BC. So maybe a little bit after that, they started going into Europe, and Europe already had agriculture. And they weren't speaking these languages. They were speaking languages that were probably more or less Semitic language, or some distantly related to languages. They had agriculture. The people had come from the Middle East and brought agriculture with them, but these they were called the Yamaha people, the wagons and the horses, and they came and they were able to conquer. They conquered all of Europe and left their languages. They mixed the native populations, but not on any. This is the thing. When you know, you can look back in history. Oh, yeah, people have always been moving around. They've always been mixing, and it's true. But the mixing isn't always happy on both sides. So the Yamnaya men had access to these European women. The European farmer men, they were losing access. They lost out. They weren't reproducing. But the Yamnaya men, the Indo-European men, were. And so Europeans today are largely a mixture of these two groups, one that had invented agriculture and the one that had, you know, invented the wheel and the ox cart. And we're kind of a mixture of the two. So I don't know if that's interesting, but
for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's important to know. And frankly, that's, as I referred to earlier about Russian history, a lot of what you just said there isn't really taught in high school or schools in general, you know, at least that in depth. So that's good to know.
Well, some of it's relatively recent. A lot of this deep history, there had been theories about it for a long time, because you had, during this period of time, say 2000 BC, there had been a cultural replacement. The types of pottery that were being made, beakers, which are, I guess, drinking cups and whatnot, but the types of potteries that were being made, a lot of there had been.
The truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Do you or someone you know suffer from chest pain, blood pressure, cholesterol, or irregular heartbeat? Are you looking for a more natural solution to overcome these health challenges? You hear the ads all the time. If this stuff's so good, why doesn't my doctor prescribe it? That's easy. Doctors are not trained in natural medicine. Extendivite Heart Tonic does want you to be as healthy as you can be, and it really works. Take Extendivite for 6 months and your doctor will say, "I don't know what you're doing, but don't stop. It's working for you." Get the dependability of Extendivite. Just see how you feel in 6 months. A 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid is only $69.95 plus shipping and handling. Call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Hello, hello, hello from beautiful Colorado. My name is Samuel Jung Kay, and I am currently the lead Shilajit hunter and master herbalist for Colorado Shilajit Company. In this video series, I will be discussing what we believe is the greatest of all adaptogenic superfoods and the single greatest natural healing remedy gifted to us by Mother Earth. I think you too will become as excited by this incredible substance called Shilajit as we were and are after our discovery of this amazing gift right here in beautiful, colorful Colorado. You may already know Shilajit by other names: Shilajit, Momio, Momi, Mami, Mineral Pitch, Asphaltum, and others. Shilajit literally translates to destroyer of weakness and conqueror of mountains. Shilajit has been in use for thousands of years and is considered as the highest valued cure-all of any earthly substance.
Look for the gold mountain and medical symbol logo in banners on republicbroadcasting.org to watch the full video and see more information. Use code GORBN when ordering. That's GORBN.
Period of time, say 2000 BC, there had been a cultural replacement. The types of pottery that were being made, beakers, which are, I guess, drinking cups and whatnot, but the types of potteries that were being made, a lot of there had been the archaeology was showing a cultural change. And so the debate had always been, okay, does this represent a movement of people or a movement of ideas, right? Were people being replaced, or was it just the ideas? And, you know, you can look at, if you were to do archaeology, like future archaeologists looking at China or Korea or Japan, would see all of a sudden in the 20th century a big shift in the way people dressed. You know, in architecture and a lot of things. Was that a replacement of people or a replacement of ideas? Well, in the case of East Asia in the 20th century, it was a replacement of ideas. The culture, the ideas were moving, the culture was moving, but the people were not being replaced. But with DNA analysis, with the ability over the past 10 or 15 years to sequence DNA, the question was answered that yes, it was partially it was a replacement of people, partially. So I don't know.
So yeah, I was just thinking, I wonder, or I hope not, but I wonder if the NSA has time to be spying on me since I'm learning Russian, you know.
Well, there's the question.
I don't even know how to answer that. A little more than two years ago in, was it April or early May of 2021, the Biden administration, he issued an executive order. It was up on the White House website, and I talked a lot about it in the spring of 2021, and it gave the secretaries of state, treasury, homeland security, and the attorney general the ability to designate somebody as somebody providing aid to Russia. Now, this is before the war started. This is almost a year before the war started, but it outlawed like certain types of assistance to Russia and allowed them these, by the way, all four Jews. And what are the odds of four random people in America being Jewish? 6 million to 1. It gave these four Jews the ability to seize not just your assets, but the assets of your family. Now, I'm not aware of it being utilized. I'm not aware of that. I don't know. Maybe it's formed the basis of some of the sanctions. I'm not sure, but I'm not aware of it being utilized. But it was just so draconian. We were not at war with Russia at the time. We're technically not at war with them now, but the war hadn't even started. And they put that through. And then the sanctions include all sorts of draconian stuff. And so simply talking about Russia, could that attract the eye of the NSA? What do you think?
I mean, I think it's possible. You know, unfortunately, we have to – I mean, it's unfortunate, I mean, that we even have to – consider this, you know, that even the thought of this, you know, just benignly learning a second language, you know, can put you on or potentially put you on a list. You know, I would say it's plausible because I've studied the Snowden documents a lot. And if you I don't know if it's still this way, but he had one of the documents. If you downloaded the Tor browser from the Tor project's home website, your IP address was put on a list, and the Lord knows what they did with this list. You know, I don't think everybody was, tapped or, you know, physically spied on. Luckily, they don't have the resources to do that, that we know of. So, but you know, that goes to a larger point that, they can do kind of what Google does, is put you in a category of cohorts. You know, and they'll have a history, and over time they can slowly build a profile on you. And well, with artificial intelligence, you know, they don't have to have an agent, you know, behind a computer to do that. Google does this. It's called federated learning of cohorts, flock, and you know, the intelligence agencies do the same thing. I don't think they have the same name for it, but you know, it's. Yeah, I would say they probably do something like that. Like, who knows? Maybe, you know, when I downloaded these apps, you know, it could be that, you know, my device fingerprint was put in a cohort, you know, and who knows? I would venture to say yes, unfortunately, but I tell you, I'm not going to let that keep me from learning another language. So I guess they'll have to live with it.
Well, so here's a question then. Obviously the NSA has massive capabilities, and 20 years ago or so they created this, I think it's like an arena sized building in Utah.
Yes. The Utah Data Center. Yeah.
Utah Data Center, which has massive capacity. What's the capacity of that compared to, say, the capacity of Google?
I think I don't know the capacity of Google, but I've heard that it's this data center. So they were going to build this in the Northeast. They had to move this data center. I forget what it's called, but it's just referred to as the Utah Data Center. That's what I'll call it for now. But so they had to move this to Utah because it was going to take so much power that they couldn't put it up in Maryland, you know, where all the other NSA buildings are. It was going to take, like, the grid couldn't handle it. So, like, they had to move it elsewhere in the nation. I mean, that gives you a good idea if you know how much juice it's sucking from the grid. Anyway, I think I've heard about it has the capacity to hold all of the world's internet traffic for the next 30 years. Somewhere like that.
All right. So it's pretty massive. And you know, what's the relationship between the NSA and various tech companies? I know that in, I don't know. I mean, but the thing is, there are people who have a lot of our data. So, for instance, what would be in a Google profile of a random person? What type of information?
It would be what apps you downloaded, your device fingerprint. Also, if you have a regular Android phone, the way Google, you can't turn off your location. This is one reason why I got a de-Googled phone. I think I've mentioned this before. It's always talking back to Google, telling it which Wi-Fi connections are in the area. And this is something called Supl that Google has a patent on. And so it's constantly referring back to Google headquarters, telling it which Wi-Fi connections are in the area. You don't have to be connected to them. It, even if your phone's on airplane mode, there have been researchers that hook up this program called Wireshark, which analyzes packets, all the packets that your phone is sending and receiving. And you can see, even in airplane mode, it's sending information back to Google headquarters telling you which Wi-Fi connections are in your area. And it's doing this to map out the entire country's Wi-Fi networks and in relation to your location. So just say you live on a street and you're driving by, right, and you have your regular Google Android on, it's picking up and sending back to Google all this information, like, that's everybody's Wi-Fi. And again, you don't have to be connected to them. So it would contain that. It would contain your location, where you go, potentially, unless your phone is in a Faraday bag or a Faraday cage. It's always going to be communicating back to Google, mainly your location, which apps you download, your browsing history, unless you do something called browser isolation, which is using one browser for one certain thing. Say you use one browser just specifically to check email. You use another browser just to, I don't know, say you have two email addresses, right? And you use another browser to check your other email, and you use specific browsers to only do one activity, right? And you have a third browser just for actual internet browsing. That's called browser isolation. Unless you're doing that, it's going to have all your browsing history. And it's there's a lot more, but you know, you kind of get the point. They can see everything. And like I just briefly said prior, it's called FLOC, Federated Learning of Cohorts. They put you in a category called cohort, and they have this artificial intelligence building a profile on you, and it's that makes it, you know, less work for an agent, you know. And the government does the same stuff, only I would argue Google probably has it down better. They've been doing it longer. And to answer your question, you asked what relation the intel agencies have with the big tech, and they're basically intertwined. I mean, there have been documents that come out, they pretty much work in conjunction with each other. So it's one big massive diarrhea of information gathering, the way I see it.
Right. And then of course you've got the, you know, phone companies who know who you're talking to and whatnot. Google's probably the best example, but there's a massive amount of data out there, and I'm sure people have had this kind of experience where maybe somebody, you know, your wife calls you up and says, get such and such at the supermarket while you're there, and then the next thing you know, you open up your email and you're getting advertisements for that very product.
Like, right. Hey, here's something funny you can try to do. Watch a foreign movie or put up a foreign movie. You don't even have to watch it, and put your phone up next to the speaker, right? And then see what kind of advertisements you get in whatever language that movie was in.
Have you done that?
I haven't done that, but I've seen videos of people doing that, and it's, you know, as you can imagine, you start getting advertisements in another language all of a sudden, right? I have started getting advertisements in Russian, which makes sense, you know. I mean, if you know, I have more than one phone, and on the one phone that I'm, you know, learning Russian on, it's, I mean, that's to be expected, you know. I'm not freaking out over that, but.
Yeah, so it's amazing the level of information they have on us. So it's these tech companies, and you know the question then is when and under what circumstances do they share this information? But I don't think that the NSA built that massive Utah data center for nothing, right? And so they almost certainly have a whole bunch of information. And then so then the question becomes, what are they doing with it? Because we're not hearing yet. We're hearing about people getting called away in the middle of the night.
So one thing the intelligence agency has been wanting to do for a long time is have these super quantum computers. And they don't particularly exist yet. It hasn't been proven that we can even build those yet. I know Google claims that they have one, but it's technically not one yet. And that's kind of a whole different subject in and of itself. But one thing they can do, potentially do with these, is break encryption. So they can go back in the past and see stuff that has been encrypted and hidden, and they could potentially charge you with stuff that you did in the past, you know. And that's a very real possibility if, you know, they get these super quantum computers, which again, they don't have yet, but it's like an Intel agency's wet dream to have these. And that's why there's so much funding being put behind these that, you know, could be built or maybe built. I don't know. Again, that's a whole nother subject, but they don't exist yet. That's a good thing. But again, those would break encryption. So it's scary to think about, I guess.
Well, okay, here's the next question. I mentioned the January 6th people. So there were several hundred people who have been arrested for having walked into the Capitol on January 6th. And they're languishing in prison. It's a horrible thing. This is absolutely such a huge outrage. I think if we weren't in the middle of so much hoax fatigue, that people would be a lot more up in arms about it. But I mean, there's just been so much going on in the past few years with the COVID lockdowns and all sorts of other outrages. But
and hey, did you know that the Charlottesville, the day before the Charlottesville rally, the men who went out with tiki torches the night before, they're being indicted. All of them. Or maybe not all of them, but, you know, some of them are.
And so this is the question. It will be the question for the Charlottesville people as that unravels or that unfolds. But for January 6th, to what extent is this data accumulation that we've been talking about in the show, to what extent has that been used in order to identify these people? And, you know, you've got facial recognition things, but then as far as I know, didn't the phone companies like AT&T and whatnot, didn't they turn over their records to the government or to the, you know, Justice Department?
I'm sure they probably did. I can't say for sure, but I'm sure they probably did. And another thing is law enforcement can use these things that are called MZ catchers, which in short, it's a device that you can, it's large, like you could fit it in the trunk of a car or potentially a big backpack. So, you know, law enforcement can walk around with these things. But what this does is it's a fake cell phone tower, and your phone thinks it's a cell phone tower, and your phone will automatically connect to it. And law enforcement have been known to use these in the past, and that's another reason. Or they could fly them on a drone also, right? So it's been, like I said, they've been known to use these before, and that's another way to get phone information without even obtaining a warrant, right? So if there's a protest or, you know, another Charlottesville rally or something like that, they could fly one of these in a drone or have it in a back of a police cruiser, you know? So, and again, they don't need a warrant for that. This hasn't been brought to the Supreme Court yet. So it used to just be your freaking IP address, right? Your IP address used to be the only thing that you could identify with, but now we have device fingerprinting, browser fingerprinting. It's everything. It's scary.
Antelope Hill Publishing is America's leading publisher of dissident books, bringing you a wide variety of new translations and original works on every subject, from the funding behind the transgender movement to firsthand memoirs of World War II previously inaccessible to English-speaking audiences. We publish books that mainstream publishers won't touch, full of information that challenges the political status quo. Whether you count yourself as a political dissident, student of history, connoisseur of philosophy, or enthusiast of exciting and thought-provoking fiction, you owe it to yourself to check out our catalog. With exclusive offerings like The Transgender Industrial Complex, Solzhenitsyn and the Right, The Open Society Playbook, Opioids for the Masses, and many more, there's something for everyone, and new titles are added every month. Check out our catalog today at antelopehillpublishing.com and use code RBNReaders2023 for 10% off your order. That's RBNReaders2023. At antelopehillpublishing.com.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Paudi Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus does not grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit drinksupertea.com. The first word is drink, spelled D-R-I-N-K, then the word super, then the word tea. The complete website is drinksupertea.com or call us at 818-965-9113, Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-965-9113. DrinkSuperTea.com.
The secret to aging like fine wine is in the vines. Syrah grape seeds and skins contain high levels of flavonoids and resveratrol. Fermentation breaks these organic compounds down into smaller molecules, penetrating these therapeutic ingredients deeper into the skin, delivering faster and more effective results. Our handmade fermented skincare products are formulated with all natural ingredients and do not contain any phthalates or parabens. Similar products can cost as much as $180. At Natural Earth Medicine, we source our ingredients from local Arizona vineyards and cold process our oils to ensure that our customers receive the highest quality product in its purest form. Learn more at our website and try our fermented skincare products today. Visit naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
This hasn't been brought to the Supreme Court yet. So it used to just be your freaking IP address, right? Your IP address used to be the only thing that you could identify with, but now we have device fingerprinting, browser fingerprinting. It's everything. It's scary. And to answer your question, yeah, they collect this to identify you. That's the sole reason why they collect this. It's to identify you.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's all gotten very, very Orwellian, very, very fast. We don't have much time left, but I had a great aunt who used to visit us when I was a little kid. She'd come with my grandmother. She's my grandmother's older sister. And she'd come, and I never really liked her. She'd get on my rocking horse. And, of course, you know, she was grown up and probably a little, I don't know if she was overweight or not. I don't remember that well. She probably wasn't overweight, but she'd get on it. And I didn't like that. Maybe she thought she was being nice and funny. But, and she would sleep on the couch in the living room because we didn't have a guest room or anything. And I remember the last time she came and there was a bit of a commotion. I remember going downstairs and my father was trying to calm her down and she was all upset. She thought she was being spied on through the electric sockets, which in the 1960s was crazy talk. Is that crazy talk today?
I don't know. I've never heard anything like that, but I'll tell you, I wouldn't put anything out the window yet. So I certainly hope not, but who knows, right?
You know, we've got the Internet of Things, right? You got your TVs. Some of these smart TVs are always on, and you can just, like, say a command to it. Well, it's always listening then. If you can just say a command to turn it on, it means it's always listening. So,
right.
I don't know. We've gotten to this place where a lot of this stuff is already happening. And if it's not happening, it's just waiting to happen. The technology's there. It's in place. And, but it's kind of creepy, kind of scary. I don't know what the future holds. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I'll say real quick, don't get a Ring doorbell or Alexa. That should be pretty much self-evident, but those run on a mesh network. They talk to each other. And if your neighbor has one and you have one, you can't undo it, right? You can't just go to the settings and turn that off. They talk to each other, and they run on a mesh network. You should look that up. But that's all.
What are they talking about?
They all send all the information back to home base, to Amazon. They run on an Amazon home network, an Amazon mesh network, I mean.
All right, well, that sounds really bad. Okay, well, thank you very much for joining me, Philbert.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, and stay safe, everyone.
And I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.